Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz with Mal Leary and Steve Missler. Well, New Hampshire has had its day in the, clouds with a few snowflakes sprinkled in, to be exact. But actually, as winter days go, it wasn't too bad for the presidential primary there. Turnout was said to be high as President Trump trounced challenger Bill Weld in the Republican primary. Democrats emerged divided. Bernie Sanders got the most votes. Pete Buttigieg, a close second. Amy Klobuchar jumped into the leader pack with her third-place finish. Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden faded. Andrew Yang, Michael Bennett, and Deval Patrick all dropped out. Nevada is next, then South Carolina, and then Maine gets its turn with 14 other states. So Steve Missler, with the knowledge of that what happens in those states could affect Maine, what do we know now about who seems to have the edge here in Maine?
Well, we don't have a good sense of who has the edge, although if you were to go on past results, you would have to say that Bernie Sanders is poised to do very well here. If you recall, in the 2016 caucuses, and this is an important point too, I'll circle back to, during the caucuses, he trounced Hillary Clinton. That, of course, was a two-way race at the time, and this is a much larger field, and it's also a primary. I think that's another key distinction here. People who tend to do well in caucuses are heavily organized, they have very energetic supporters, and in a primary, it's a straight up, you know, people vote, and that's it. And so, you know, turning out that vote is very important to how the candidates do. And I think Bernie Sanders has a operation here that's ready to go and has already been active. It's, you know, he held a rally here back over the Labor Day weekend, and there has been some organizing events up to that and since that. And now, of course, Elizabeth Warren also has troops on the ground here in an organization, and Pete Buttigieg also does as well. Now, and then, of course, Mike Bloomberg does, too. But let's get to him in a second. What we do know is that those operations have their limits. Elizabeth Warren had a huge operation in New Hampshire, and it did not pan out for her at all. And, you know, the other factor here is that, I mean, I think voters are just really, really split here. Bernie Sanders has support that's probably the most sticky. He has the most committed supporters. And it seems like everybody else is just sort of trying to find the right candidate to go to who can beat Trump. You know, one thing I noticed in the exit polling in New Hampshire that was very interesting is that very few of the late-breaking undecideds broke for Sanders. Most of them broke for Buttigieg or Amy Klobuchar, who had a very surprising and strong finish there, a third-place finish. And so that dynamic will be in play, I think, in Maine, too, depending on the results of South Carolina and Nevada.
Some of the conventional wisdom is that the Democratic Party seems to be splitting kind of between a minority left-wing faction and a more majority moderate faction that can't seem to find its candidate.
That's right. And the conventional wisdom also says that, you know, Amy Klobuchar's rise may have come at a cost to Pete Buttigieg in New Hampshire.
Let's remember, folks, we're really talking here about delegates. And when you talk about delegates, it's Sanders and Buttigieg right now in a dead heat. Nobody's got the advantage there. Sanders says, I got more votes, but that's like Hillary Clinton getting more votes in 2016 than Donald Trump. And we don't have President Hillary Clinton. We have President Donald Trump because of the Electoral College. The delegate selection process is a pretty good analogy to that. And right now, it's wide open. It's basically a tie between the lead progressive, Sanders, and Buttigieg. And that is going to play out in Nevada. It's going to play out in South Carolina. But more importantly, in those 14 states that are going to hit on March 3rd, of which we're one, there's going to be this attempt by these folks to reach all of these states. But who's got the resources to do that? Two people, Bloomberg and Starr. They're the billionaires in this race. They can spend whatever money they want to, and they are in all of those states. That could totally change the picture we're talking about in this election 3 weeks from now when those results are in.
Well, and that actually, I guess, brings us to Mike Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City, who not only is spending a lot of money, Mal, on advertising, but is also spending a lot of money on staff, those boots on the ground in all of those states.
He is. And what we're looking at is a new dynamic Well, it's not really due. It started in 2016, but it's really come into a full-blown situation this election, where you've got not just the over-the-air paid advertising trying to reach voters, you've got an incredible effort in social media to target voters and reach them there, as well as the traditional ground game, which Bernie Sanders was very successful at caucus states, identifying his people and getting them to go to those caucuses. So you have this different dynamic that's underway that's really fueled by money. And the two folks in this race, I mean, not that Sanders hasn't got money, not that Buttigieg doesn't have money, but when you compare it to basically the unlimited checkbooks of these two billionaires, you have to wonder what kind of an impact is that going to have as they pour money into all parts of this electoral triad, as I might call it, and other folks might be able to put the money into TV ads or put the money into social media ads, but not do all three.
Yeah. The other thing that Mike Bloomberg did this week, of course, was he also announced a bunch of endorsements and is beginning to staff up in Maine in advance of the primary. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you've got an interesting situation there that you've got some very prominent folks from past elections. Obviously, Mike Mishu, who was successful in Congress for more than a decade, failed in his race for governor, but he's extremely well-known and still well-liked in Democratic Party circles. He's leading up the effort, but he's also got people like Kay Rand. Now, Kay's not known much outside of the political circles, but she was chief of staff to Governor King and to Senator King in his first term and ran all three of his successful elections. She knows Maine. She knows Maine electorate. She knows how to reach those folks. So she's a key person. A major voting group in Maine, quite frankly, is veterans. And to have Major General Bill Libby, who's retired now, but it was the Commissioner of Defense and Veterans Services, head of the National Guard for a long time under two different governors. When you've got him out there endorsing Bloomberg, saying he's the only one that can defeat Trump and we've got to do that, you know, you're seeing some real powerful firepower, if you will, coming to Mike Bloomberg's campaign.
And I would just add to that that Bloomberg is also wielding probably the biggest weapon that any Democratic candidate can, which is his platform is essentially beat Trump. I mean, I can't think of any other policy initiative that he has talked about with any great passion other than defeating Trump. That's what he's talking about. He's engaging with the president on Twitter in a way that's just pretty astounding. It reminds me of the Hunger Games, only it's in the reverse, where the people from the Capitol are actually the tributes and fighting to the death here. I think Democratic voters, by and large, that is all they really care about at this point. And the primary, right, is, you know, certainly there are factions of the Democratic Party that care deeply about Medicare for all and some of these other issues. But at the end of the day, especially some of these center left and maybe more moderate Democrats, what they want is to defeat this president. And I think that's why you see that split in the field. And it may also be one of the reasons why Mike Bloomberg, in addition to the vast resources that he has at his disposal, why he can rise, especially if Joe Biden continues to fall.
Yeah, it's interesting. Bloomberg has also said that even if he is not the nominee, he's going to spend a lot of money on this campaign to defeat Trump. And I kind of wonder how that plays politically. You know, is that really a smart thing to say to give voters an out, or is it perhaps a way of endearing yourself to the Democratic base that you're going to need to build up?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know what the answer is, frankly, but it is interesting. And he did say, I mean, when he made his stop here in Maine a few weeks ago, you know, he's not just going to pour money in. He's going to keep his offices open. And he just opened another one. In addition to Scarborough, he's now opening an office in Bangor. So if he's true to his word, you know, those offices could be at the Democratic nominee's disposal going forward.
All right. Well, in the first week after the impeachment vote, Maine Senator Susan Collins has tried to get back to regular business, announcing substance abuse treatment grants, housing grants, speaking to Maine police chiefs, meeting with the leaders of Friends of Acadia, collecting the Congressional Lyme Champion Award, holding a hearing on home health care funding, and joining Democrat Dianne Feinstein in applauding a House vote to create a Smithsonian Women's History Museum in Washington. But Steve Missler, she has to keep answering questions about the behavior of President Trump.
Yes, she does. And I don't know that many people know of any of those things that you just listed off, but I'm sure Senator Collins is thankful that you did. But the thing that I think is most noteworthy about what's happening here with Senator Collins is that I think in her ideal scenario, she would have cast her vote. She had her explanation for acquitting the president on both impeachment charges. But I think she inadvertently created a long tail for this thing, because she also gave an interview to CBS News, which continues to shadow her, because she said that she thought that he had learned a lesson. Now, she walked that back and said that those that she should have said it, that her comments were more aspirational, that she hoped he would. Then she said that, you know, whether or not he learned a lesson had no bearing on her acquittal vote.
President Trump keeps creating the problem for her. Mm-hmm. For example, we've got this latest crisis where the attorney general, who's been very supportive of Trump, comes out and says, you know, he really should stop doing these tweets because they're making it difficult for me to do my job to enforce the laws of the United States of America. And then the President Trump tweets back and says, well, I haven't interfered yet, but I can do that if I want to. So now Senator Collins is going to have to answer the question, do you think the president is right in saying that he can do that? He keeps fueling this problem for all of those moderate Republicans by coming up with these outrageous comments that simply get people upset across the board.
Yeah, and the other thing he did too is that he admitted in an interview with a Fox News host, he did send his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, to Ukraine to dig up dirt on his political rivals, which is a direct contradiction of what he said and has been saying, and his attorneys were saying throughout the entire impeachment trial. And it reminds me of this quote in this miniseries of Chernobyl. And it basically says, every lie we tell incurs a debt to the truth. But eventually, the truth comes and collects that debt. Now, my coda to this is that President Trump has a long history of saying falsehoods. And, the general consensus is that debt to the truth is rarely paid by him, but it is paid by the people that either countenance his behavior or enable it. And I think that's a lesson to be learned here, but it doesn't seem to be being learned in Washington. And I don't know who pays the debt at the end of the day, but it may not be the president.
Well, also March 3rd, Mainers are going to be voting on whether to repeal the state's new vaccination law. Now, this is the one that bars the use of religious or philosophical exemptions. Mal, we're starting to see some ads from the Maine Families for Vaccines. That's the group that's going to urge a no vote on question one. But we're learning that some of the funding for that campaign is coming from vaccine makers. Now, is that playing into the hands of the vaccine opponents who say a yes on one vote is a vote against Big Pharma?
Well, that's possible, but we really don't know. There's no empirical data about how Mainers feel on this issue. The whole question revolves around who do you believe? I mean, both sides were trotting out doctors to support their cause, which to the average Joe citizen is going to be like, well, this is interesting. This doctor says this and this doctor says that. Who do I believe?
Yeah, and I think the people who support the people's veto, I mean, their campaign is sort of predicated on the fact that Big Pharma is the boogeyman that some people believe that it is. And I just don't know how widespread the public opinion is on that belief. I don't know if people are that distrustful of pharmaceutical companies. That seems to be the central thrust of their argument here. And the fact that, you know, a pharmaceutical-backed PAC is running ads, you know, it certainly plays into the people's veto narrative, but I don't know how persuasive that is for voters. The other issue, too, is that pharmaceutical companies and their production of vaccines is only it's a fraction of their profits. It's not that much. In fact, it wasn't profitable at all up until very recently.
All right. That's Steve Missler, our State House Bureau Chief. And with us, too, is Mal Leary, our Senior Political Correspondent. And that's our Maine's Political Pulse for this week. The Pulse podcast is updated Friday afternoons. You can hear it on mainepublic.org or download it from wherever you get your podcasts. Most of The Pulse can also be heard on Weekend Edition Sunday on Maine Public Radio. We'll also air an excerpt each Monday morning on Morning Edition. Willis Ryder Arnold is our producer. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Erwin Gratz.